Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mahmoud could have been our son. I'd have objected to the name, and for family reasons, you'd have insisted on it. We could have bought him a crib with a blue quilt and hung spinning musical animals to coax him to sleep, could have stayed up all night for his first tooth, experimenting with various formulas, because my breasts couldn't produce enough milk for his voracious appetite. And with the new Nikon camera, we could have captured his first step, and his verbal skills would have wiped the floor with your niece's skills, of course. We could have disagreed over his elementary school. Nothing wrong with public education, you'd have said, and I'd have demanded a private one. You'd have turned your face toward me as you counted our few remaining dollars to my wailing about balancing the budget. We would have been happy, his first school bag in one hand, his other hand waving to the neighbor's girl before waving to us. His teacher would have complained, as teachers are wont to do, and we'd have called her names for her blindness to the genius of our only son. Yes, we would have brought him a battery-operated car, built him a paper plane that doesn't fly, maintained his teeth white, flipped his collar for coolness, and he'd have loved me more than you. Because of issues beyond my grasp, your jealousy would have grown mysterious. And when his voice changed, he'd hate us both and love the neighbor's girl more. Rumination would have haunted us for hours at night, our whispers advising us to be patient, let go, observe, from a distance. Then you'd have lost your wits over his first cigarette, the hidden pack in the laundry room, but his tremulous voice would prevent you from slapping him with an open palm. You'd have forgiven him. You're kind like that. He'd only smoked in secret. But the first rock he'd have thrown at soldiers at the checkpoint to raise his heroic stock in Manel's eyes would have declared war in our house. Biting followed by flying slippers. Nightly debates wouldn't have helped us to core solutions. I'd have to carry him between my teeth, fly him from one neighborhood to another to shield him. But he'd run away. That would be who he'd always been. A misguided kid who saps the heart and soul. That's who he was. Still, you were martyred 8 years before he was born, and he was martyred 8 years after you were gone.
That was Maya Abu al Hayat's poem Mahmoud from her collection You Can Be the Last Leaf, translated by Fadi Judah, out from Milkweed Editions. Reading it was Marsha Links Qualey, my co-host. I'm Ursula Lindsay, and this is episode 75 of the Bulaq podcast, coming to you as usual from Amman and Rabat, and featuring the work of Abu al Hayat and other Palestinian poets in this episode.
Yeah, so let's just tell you a bit about Maya Abu al Hayat for those who don't know, although you may have heard about her on the episode when we talked about Book of Ramallah, which she edited. She is the author of 4 collections of poetry, 4 novels, and many children's picture books. She's the director of the Palestine Writing Workshop, which has projects encouraging both reading and writing, and which has fostered some of the best of Arabic children's literature available now. Her own acclaimed children's books, The Blue Pool of Questions, is available in translation from Penny Candy Books, translated by Hanan Awad. So as I said, she was editor this year of the Book of Ramallah, an anthology of short stories published by Kama Press. And You Can Be the Last Leaf is forthcoming next year, 2022. Abu al-Hayat currently lives in Jerusalem and works in Ramallah.
And it's a beautiful collection. That poem in particular kind of killed me. This poem in which you are suddenly have the rug pulled out from underneath you at the end with this double mourning of a former lover and of a child who didn't come into existence. Extremely powerful. Yeah.
Losing the imagined child and even the possibility of having this child.
And the theme of sort of motherhood and children and family and intimate daily life is a big part of the atmosphere of these poems, which are a lot, I feel like, about sort of the daily struggle to be a person, to be a writer, to be a mother under the occupation. There's a lot of just mentions of sort of checkpoints and the daily negotiation of fear and anxiety and hostility that you have to make as a Palestinian.
Just to sort of survive in this, but also to like insist upon herself and insist upon laughter and to sort of broaden the space that is available for her and her words and the people around her.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact line. This is one of the things that's hard for reading poetry for me, is that afterwards, it's kind of like listening to music. Because it's not plot driven, I always am sort of left grasping, trying to remember all the things that struck me. But she has a line in one of the poems about, I think, not being interested in just being a survivor.
Right. Yes.
Something along those lines. It's a wanting to find, you know, meaning and joy in the difficulties of that. As we speak, just days before this episode is recorded, the Israeli authorities have designated six of the most prominent Palestinian human rights NGOs and civil society organizations as terrorist organizations, which just goes to show that, you know, there's no form of human rights monitoring that is allowable.
Right. Mahmoud Darwish has poems in which he refers to the poem as a bomb and the poem as terrorism, you know, in a tongue-in-cheek sense, of course, that anything that asserts the self is a danger.
I mean, that is the situation that Palestinians find themselves in. No matter what tactics they pursue, whether they're creative or diplomatic or invoking boycotts or protests or just self-expression or appeals to international law, it is all considered illegal and terroristic and threatening. We're also in the midst of the olive harvest in Palestine, and Palestinian villages are having to try and like organize themselves to protect themselves from attacks by settlers in which they vandalize thousands of olive trees and like physically assault people who are trying to pick olives. I think, you know, this is one of the many maddening things about being Palestinian, is that as Darwish himself said too, like, not only are you dispossessed and done wrong, but then you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to even claim your own losses, to even proclaim them, to even just tell the truth of what's happening to you. That is constantly denied.
Yeah, and so these both, you know, many of the poets that we're talking about today, most of the poets we're talking today are of a, you know, a later generation than Mahmoud Darwish. Maya Abdul-Hayat was born in 1980. I think, you know, of this sort of generation of Palestinian poets writing now, writing this very vibrant poetry of that is so deeply rooted in a home, a family, a body, in laughter. And one of the things I really enjoyed about this collection was spending time with her poetic voice. You know, I think there were so many surprises in the poems, but also I just enjoyed her her wit and her her, you know, you turn a corner and she's just sort of unafraid of, yeah, describing the kid will love me more, Mahmoud, he'll love me more than he loves you, obviously, you know. And I just, you know, really I related so much, not necessarily, obviously my life is very different from Maya Abdul-Hayat's, but the sort of questions and concerns that animate me, the things that I think about, I found reflected so much in these poems.
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes is worrying about your children, which seems like a pretty universal theme, although obviously she's living it under particularly intense circumstances. Yeah, there's a vividness to a lot of the details. There's an intimacy, right? A lot of it takes place in kind of small, intimate settings, right? It's a lot in the home or just in the street, in the neighborhood, in the body. There's poems about love too, about desire, and a lot of poems about anxiety though, and concern. She has one poem where the opening line is, "Every time I leave the house, it's a suicide."
Yes,
it's suicide.
I love that poem. Yes, yes,
yeah.
And then every time you, I'm just trying to remember. This is not the line, but every time you come back, it's like a failed suicide or a failed attempt.
Right. Yeah. And also, like you said, of this later generation of Palestinian poets, where I don't know if this applies to everyone, but like there's again this focus on like the daily lived reality and not on almost a rejection of sort of like bigger ideologies and bigger myths, and which have proven probably quite disappointing. And you know, she has a poem entitled "I Suffer a Phobia Called Hope." There's a kind of you know, determination to embrace the reality we live in, and say what it is. There's not there's no grandiloquence at all to it, right? There's no like celebration of, you know, sort of resistance or martyrdom. It's not that there's no celebration of human dignity or capacity, but it's kept at an, I think, individual level. There's a kind of skepticism, I think, about a lot of narratives and myths around.
And I think sometimes people talk about sort of a rejection of political poetry and a rise of individual poetry about the body and family. And I don't think any of the poets that we're going to talk about today in any sense reject the political in their poetry. There is absolutely the political everywhere in the sort of stance and in the way that things are described, but not the sort of, yes, not in a nationalist or in an, any kind of easy sense where you feel that they know what the ending is going to be, or even what they necessarily even want to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you absolutely. It can't not be political, in a way, Palestinian poetry. Like even if you're writing about your most mundane daily experiences, it seeps in everywhere. Which also we saw in that lovely short film from the Palestinian short film, The Present, which came out this year. And again, was just a very mundane story about a husband and father trying to go buy a refrigerator for his wife, this short film. And it was all just about navigating checkpoints, which I think is this incredibly taxing experience, daily experience on everyone.
Particularly for somebody like Abul Hayat, who lives in Jerusalem and works in Ramallah and has to cross every single work day.
And where sort of every square foot of these cities is contested, and there's such a huge effort to also change the demographic balance of these cities and to expropriate Palestinian families from their homes. And that's something else that we saw recently. But to get back also to the question of her relationship to myth and narrative and nationalism, she has one line that I liked so much where she says, "Each time an opportunity arises for me to not believe in one thing or another, I smile from ear to ear to let all this freedom in."
Yeah.
I loved that.
I do too. And I feel like she has such a broad sympathy such a huge imagination. It's a poetry that believes in contradictory things, can hold one thing in its mind, two things in its mind at once. And yet, also, of course, believes in reality. The occupation exists, despite anything else.
Yeah. And in terms of the style itself of the poems, there's so many of them that at the end often have just a kind of great thudding, evocative twist, like the last couple lines. There's something sometimes with a bit of mystery to it. You're not sure how to interpret it. You're not sure what it means, but it just kind of thuds like a heartbeat there at the end.
And really stays with
you.
The ending of My House, which is the opening poem in the collection. It talks a lot about her upbringing, her family life, how she finds a house, how you build a house for yourself, of course, not in the physical sense alone, but in the metaphorical sense. And she also, shouts out to Amjad Nasser, which, it was greatly touching to me because he's one of my favorite poets as well. And he passed recently. And then it ends, "I will raise my house on the backs of horses that will carry it to the fields. There my legs will pause." And you're like, what? What? Then the legs of the poem pause. And I'm sort of left there, paused on horseback with the house carried into a field. And it's a different image. There's not a horse earlier in the poem. And it really leaves you with so much. She can do this sort of hairpin turn of moving from narrative to moving to this sort of more song-like lyric poetry that then just leaves you there to figure it out yourself.
I'll contribute another one that proves that it speaks to this same point. She has this poem called Search. It's just basically, you don't know what she's looking for. It describes her looking for something through her house, behind couches and in the bowl in the hallway. And then at the end, it says, "I listened to the weather forecast one last time. As I rummage through the kitchen cabinets, I see that I need a new pressure cooker. Maybe you can leave in it your intractable diseases. The sugar in the pantry needs some ants and my heart a vent." And again,
yes,
and it's not a explicable line to me, but it really hits me.
Yeah, I mean, you can invent some meanings for it. Your heart needs a vent, it needs some way of getting rid of some of the things in it. So the sugar in the pantry needs some ants.
The sugar in the pantry needs some ants.
It does need ants. Everybody's sugar needs some ants. Come on. There are so many of the lines. I Some of her poems are so crowded in this, like you're living in a house with so many of these different things going on. There's the sugar, the ants, and then there's these lines that just I don't have an easy explanation for them, but they really stay with me. There's this one, Your Laughter, which I find to be such a strong political poem. The day you explain your laugh to anyone should never come. Your laugh would lose its prestige. Laughter is the excess knowledge no one takes seriously. And that line, laughter is the excess knowledge no one takes seriously, I don't know what I think it means, but I love it. I feel that it's important and it's correct.
Yeah.
Whatever it means.
Even the poem that gives the title to the collection, it's a very short poem. I've reread it now, I think 10 times, and I find it very sort of enigmatic, and, you know, it doesn't have a single clear reading for me. I really like it. So it's called You Can't.
Mm.
They will fall in the end, those who say you can't. It'll be age or boredom that overtakes them, or lack of imagination. Sooner or later, all leaves fall to the ground. You can be the last leaf. You can convince the universe that you pose no threat to the tree's life. Now, the end of that, I get, I think, pretty clearly. I mean, this is incredibly poignant, again, from people who are accused all the time of being nothing but a threat, and whose very existence is so constantly undermined. But this play on, first of all, it's not clear who you is. I mean, you and they are both not specified.
Right.
And then you know, the end is you can be the last leaf, you can convince the universe, but the title of the poem is You Can't.
Mm.
So there's some tension there.
Right. Who is saying you can't, and who is saying you can,
and you can't what? What are they right. saying that you can't? And then the title seems to almost agree with them that you can't. I don't know. It's but there's a lot of poems like that where the mystery of it is very moving.
Yeah, and I just want to say that. So I read a lot of poetry as a teenager, which I think many, whatever people do who like words, and I didn't struggle that much about what it meant, and I think I just accepted if somebody said that so and so is a good poet, I agreed, yes, so and so is a good poet, and I didn't necessarily have my own sort of strong opinions, and then I became very uncertain, like I think many non-poet readers do. I think most people, if they read a novel, they can tell you whether or not they thought it was a good novel. Even they're a non-specialist, but they have a sense of what works and doesn't work. But I think people become nervous, or at least I become nervous, about saying, is this a good poetry collection? Is this, you know? And it's sort of only recently that I've given myself permission, or been given permission, or somehow have decided that I can allow myself to like a poetry collection or not like a poetry collection, and then that is an important determining criteria about whether I think it's good. And
I hear you. Sorry, were you finished?
Yeah,
you sure?
Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I was gonna say, I didn't actually read much poetry as a teenager, and I have maybe more than you. Like I'm not that comfortable evaluating it, and also because I'm like a narrative plot junkie, like stories are what you know hook me, and I'm obsessed with, and I think also like a kind of analytical reader, like someone who parses everything,
right.
So it's almost like I have to give myself permission to just experience poetry. Again, it's more like music for me. Like I have to have an emotional reaction. But then I can't sort of break it down as easily. into the constituent elements.
Right. There's these moments that I think is it Proust who refers to them as song in a novel. And I feel like there's so many of those moments of song where the poem elevates above itself and you don't know what's going on, but it just it carries you with it. And I think, you know, maybe it is because people have told me, oh, that's not a good poet and that's not a good, and there is, you know, there are of course specialist readers and they know many things and they have a great background of context that I don't have. But I think it is important to be able to pick up a poetry collection and say, I love Maya Abul-Hayat's poetry because I can hear it and I can see it and I can relate to it and I can feel myself in it and my concerns and I feel myself growing bigger from it. And, you know, I don't know what the technical criteria are necessarily, the way I could list them all for the novel.
I think personally, my guess would be that if I just read more poetry, I would get better and better at articulating those criteria as well. Like part of it is just, you know, with any art form, it's like just the amount of your exposure to it is what eventually gives you kind of like the tools to like make explicit your initial reactions and maybe to fine tune them, maybe to like, you know, for the reactions themselves to become more sophisticated sometimes or more nuanced. I don't know, but so I think that helps. I'm really happy that we're doing, I mean, we do usually talk only about novels and
right,
prose
right.
And I'm really happy we're doing this episode. I think that this and the other collection we're going to talk about next, which is by Najwan Darwish, are both, you know, very strong collections. I enjoyed reading a lot. Should we read a poem by Najwan Darwish before we get into talking about who he is?
Yeah, sure. We could just read the title poem, Exhausted on the Cross.
Right, sure. That's the title of the collection as well. Will you do it?
I will.
Great.
Exhausted on the cross. The ones hanging are tired, so bring us down and give us some rest. We drag histories behind us, here where there's neither land nor sky. Lord, sharpen your knife and give your sacrifice its rest. You had no mother or father, and you never saw your brothers hanging from the cold talons of dawn. You loved no one, and no one ever abandoned you, and death never ate from your hands. You cannot know our pain. I'm not King David. I won't sit at the gate of regret and sing your psalms of lamentation after the sins. Bring me down. Let me have my rest. Yes, so that was the title poem from Exhausted on the Cross, translated by Karim James Abuzaid, who translated, of course, the whole collection that came out this year. It's the second translation of Najwan's that Karim translated. So Najwan was born in 78, so also is from this same generation. He published his first collection in 2000, and he has, I think, 8 collections of poetry out. Or I don't know, maybe 9 by now. And in 2014, New York Review of Books published Karim's translation of his Nothing Left to Lose, which was its first translation from Arabic. And that got a lot of acclaim and it was up for several awards. And then this year they brought out Exhausted on the Cross, which is another like big collection. And it doesn't sound like a lot of pages from, if you, you know, from a novel reader's perspective, I think it's, you know, 120 or something. But it feels very big. There's a lot.
Yeah, and there's I think 6 different sections, and some of them are quite different styles of poetry. I mean, I liked how far and wide he ranges. both in the types of poems that he writes, in the references. There's quite a bit of sort of conversations with other poets, poems inspired by poems which sort of in which he sort of either casts another poet as a character or is speaking to him or speaking for him. And it also, it's vast geographically. I mean, there's quite a few different settings, poems about Egyptian workers in Jordan and Nepalese workers in the Gulf and a woman from Zanzibar on pilgrimage in Medina. There's this kind of cosmopolitan element of, you know, although it returns again and again, of course, they're poems by a Palestinian poet, very much about Palestine, but there's all these kind of, it shoots off in all these interesting directions too.
Right. Yeah. He's not the only one who's exhausted, I think.
you mean, in terms of like his solidarity with like other.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. That's very much there. There's parallels, there's connections to other forms of suffering or to other poets who have found themselves in difficult positions. There was a poem, there's a poem called Let the Journey End Here. And it starts off reimagining a trip. I'm going to forget who the medieval poet is. Is it Hafez in this case? It's imagining the trip of a famous medieval poet who goes to Egypt, who goes on this like caravan ride to Egypt. And so most of it is, you know, a reimagining of, I think, this true historical event. There's even a quote, I think, from the account, which made me smile. It says, and when they came to Fustat in Egypt, the city's people saved the camels and took their riders in as honored guests. They were a joyous folk, and it seemed their faces were the first rays of the dawning sun. And then it says, so let the journey end here. Let it end with those four verses. Remember them and them alone when they're throwing you into Cairo Airport's detention room.
Yes, I remember that.
And it just knocked the breath out of me. I mean, one, because I'm familiar, you know, with Egypt. Of course, anything that sort of references to Egypt always kind of carry an extra weight for me. You know, this again, this experience that Palestinians have all the time with travel and, you know, constantly having trouble leaving places and getting into places and the security scrutiny and the lack of papers and, you know, all across the Arab region and the world. But just that twist again at the end where it moves from this the long ago historical account, the poet in ancient times and the poet today.
What it means to travel becomes different.
Yeah. And he tells you something at the same time. He tells you, don't remember this, but I'm telling it to you.
Right.
Like, let me tell it to you and erase it.
But I'm ending on that image anyway.
Right.
So yeah, it is a wonderful, contradictory image as well.
Yeah. I would say, like, compared to Abul Hayat's poetry, Najwan Darwish's poetry is much more, a lot of the poems are more like explicit stories. Like they are, you know, anecdotes or narratives that are quite clearly laid out, quite clearly articulated. There's less, you know, ambiguity. It's clearer, I think. The
images import. Sort of ring in a succession, and you see one clear thing in your head. Whereas hers, sometimes I've got six images jockeying for position at the same time.
Yeah, and this image that gives the title to the collection, and that he, I think, comes back to more than once. Right, there's another poem that also uses this metaphor of crucifixion. I think the one that says Christ was a fidei, like just like you, but he was condemned and crucified in the sea of a single day, while you, your cross is raised with every dawn. You know, obviously, like it's saying something about Palestinian suffering and the potential for some sort of rebirth. I think is built into that image as well. Some sort of new beginning.
Right. And with the sort of, so sometimes the poems are cyclical, right? They seem to move in a circle or a cycle. And sometimes there's a kind of a collapse of history, like in the poem that ends up in the airport detention center.
Right.
Like all these moments are happening at the same time. But in that, there's also the possibility of, you know, you're in the detention center, but those faces, the smiling faces, are still real. They still are vibrant. They're still remembered. They still exist alongside the airport detention center.
Well, I think so much of this poetry takes place right between hope and hopelessness, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between despair and the belief that, you know, some form of, you know, joy or hope or resistance or meaning is possible to be rescued out of the suffering, out of what seems like never ending suffering. And Darwish has several poems that explicitly talk about how the act, I mean, being a poet itself, is sort of the way in which he can play a role within this. And again, there's a tension between what he says: will it have meaning or not? Will it be forgotten or not? Like, will it matter
right.
or not? He has a poem I liked called An Obituary. And he says, he hoped his obituary would read as follows. He fought the invaders as best he could. He wasn't victorious, but neither was he defeated. In oblivion, he made a life for 1,000 years to come. He died fulfilling his poetic obligations.
Yes, I love that line about fulfilling his poetic obligations. Yeah, there's a lot of poems in which he imagines 1,000 years into the future. The year 2222, for example. And then this in this family poem. So although, you know, his poetry is not, you know, about existing in the family in the same way as Maya's is, he has this beautiful poem called Family, where he also says, even after 1,000 years, I still won't be a father. So I find it unusual in a man's poetry that he talks about children or the family at all, but he's sort of insisting, even after 1,000 years, I still won't be a father. I'll stay where I am. I'll remain one of the youngest and most reckless of these children. And I'll fight to the bitter end for the right not to be a father to my children. So he's still talking about this very... you know, life of the family and the home, although insisting that he's not going to take part in it. He's not going to become part of this sort of traditional patriarchal family. He's not going to be the father.
Right. But it's not so much about not making, having family bonds, right? It's about not playing that role, it seems to me, that traditionally assigned role. Because earlier in the poem, he says, I have no offspring either. The children born amid the shelling in these sullen hospitals are simply companions joining this family we've created from the ruins of our families.
Which I thought was so beautiful. Yes, yes.
It's saying these children that are born in these rooms, they are our companions. You're already seeing them as, you know, your full equals, because you're equals in this suffering, really, right? I mean, and that you're rebuilding a family in a different way,
right? Without the children being the children are his companions, and it also opens. I don't have a widow who'll be there to receive the poet's coat of arms and dole out downcast smiles. So he doesn't have a relationship with women either, where, you know, he's got a wife who's there to, like, sort of be his widow after he dies and whatever, sort out his poetic legacy, and be his, you know, his the widow of a martyr. He has a different relationship both with children and with women, and he insists not to be that sort of patriarchal father.
It's a bit like Abul Hayat's line about not believing things giving you freedom. Like, there's a kind of, I feel like this is a celebration of some kind of freedom, that I'm not their father, they're my companions, I don't need a weeping wife. Like, we're all equal and individuals in this other kind of family that were created from the ruins of our families.
Although she also has this beautiful line that I'm searching for in, is it in from in the poem Return, about it's you know, about how sort of the world is sort of designed before we get there. Our words about the free soul beliefs and the innocent land is part of the design. So, you know, it's like the desire for freedom, but also at the same time recognizing that these words that we use about freedom and about these things are given to us as well. And so we're just trying to make our way and make our poems out of these concepts that we didn't create whole cloth. So it made me sort of doubt freedom as well, as a lens of seeing these poems.
I mean, I don't think there's a lot of certainty in these poetic universes on purpose, right? I think you're right. Everything gets questioned, and certainly I don't think it's a romantic vision of, you know, the power of, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, there's both, right? Obviously, you know, these people believe and are enacting, like, a real, I don't want to use the word resistance. I don't know why. I'm always very leery of, like, over romanticizing the Palestinian cause, because I feel like it takes away from people to just make them, you know what I mean? To be overly sentimental about it and stuff, like, or to make people seem victims or heroes or so on. And I think this poetry very much resists that. But there is this kind of, like, enacting of the very limits of what language can do in the poems, right? Like, they do amazing things, and yet they point to the fact that that's not enough.
Right, right, right. And yet sometimes it is enough. You know, sometimes the poem...
we're confused in a very in a very good way as readers, right?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes at the end of the poem, there's, like, a sense of satisfaction. Sometimes it does feel like it does what it aimed to do. It met its poetic obligations.
Well, don't you think, I mean, that, like you said something earlier about cycles, and in Darwish's poetry, this is quite explicit, you know, in a variety of ways. There's sort of natural cycles. There's this poem, there's this poem about dawn coming, for example. It says, "Dawn lies behind heavy curtains, behind a heavy age. Dawn always lies behind. In the twists and turns, the abysses, the chasms, dawn lurks, as slender as a sword. The unsheathed dawn of God has darkness for a scabbard." And I think there's this cycle of, like, you know, some poems ending on a note of real hopelessness, right? Of death, of futility, and some ending on the opposite of that. Because that is what you're, you know, that is the full existence that's being conveyed. And really, it just depends where in that cycle of you know, springtime coming or the dawn coming or hope coming, the voice of the poet happens to be. Like they feel differently in different moments, I'm sure. And it, and you get the full spectrum here of
yeah, there's
moments.
Another one from the Rumble. Fate's never heard me sigh. Did it think I'd take to the streets to parade my misery? Did it think I'd fall in love with my victimhood? Fate wrecked us, but still we emerge from the rubble with satisfaction on our faces.
Which you can read as celebratory or as bitter.
Right. Bitter
both
satisfaction.
Ways,
absolutely.
They might be pretending.
It's not joy on their faces. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Satisfaction is a much more sort of, determined. It's satisfaction. It's not happiness. It's just, you know, I'm reading this monolingually, this is not a facing page translation. So I just have access to what Karim chose for this, for that word. But.
Well, in any case, they read both of these translations read very, very well. Like you say, without access to the original, but they are an incredibly, enjoyable reading experience.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this image of this chandelier crashing that is so intense for me, and I just feel it crashing over and over again in Exhausted on the Cross. Yes, I mean, Karim James, both of them are poets themselves. Fehdi Judah is a poet, and Karim James Abu Zayd is also a poet. And I think I'm sure both of them worked also with the poets themselves in crafting these as poems in English.
In fact, and Fehdi Judah, we should mention, has a new poetry collection of his own that I think is already out, about to come out. I think already out.
Yeah, I think it's already out.
And this is also from Milkweed, and the title of the collection is Tethered to the Stars. And it's another thing on my long, long list of books that someone's going to bring me back from the States, hopefully next month. But somebody shared one of the poems from that collection online, and I loved it. Maybe we could read it.
Sure. Did you want to read it, or I've got it open as well?
Okay, you go for it.
All right, Dehiscence. I forgot to say goodbye to the kids. I knelt into my weeping until my heart broke me awake. My forehead touched the floor. If dream is memory, I was captured in a van, incarcerated. I was and wasn't a leader. The prison was a camp in the wilderness. Its warden was kind. Unkindness came from the rules, which came from behind desert mountains. I didn't say goodbye to my kids. We were watching a soccer game when it happened. My boyhood team is a cities that was steeped in shipping slaves, but that's long ago now. Two of the goal scorers were Muslim, one Senegalese, the other Turkish, who would have us believe he's German. I didn't say goodbye to the kids. I sobbed. I shook. I woke up with a dry face and a cloven heart. I uttered the Arabic word for it. There's a world out there, people no less beautiful than you are. I stayed in bed for an hour, less water, with time. I recalled the moment I no longer let my father touch me. No more his little boy, I parted with a tenderness that wouldn't visit me the same again. I felt his acceptance, unaware he'd begun waiting for mine. It was after lunch. We were on the couch. He stroked my hair, neck, and forearm. It felt good. Then I felt older. Slowly, I got up, walked away, his fingers trailing the air of my wake. Both of us wordless. I didn't say goodbye to my kids. There's a world out there, people who don't ask me what I'm about to say. You're not time. I served with time, and you're not it.
Again, I love the ending of that. It's another one of these kind of heart thumping. The version that I had seen was slightly different, actually. So, like, just there's some small changes in the language. So, I wonder if I saw an earlier draft or, you know,
or a later one. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they're small. It doesn't change the overall content very much, but yeah, there's slightly different drafts of it. And the title of this poem was a word I had to look up, dehiscence, which I guess is a medical term that means when the sides of a wound don't knit together. Yeah.
Right. And Fadi is also a medical doctor in his other life.
And I mean, so he's a poet and he's the translator of one of the collections that we just discussed of Maya's. And he really seems to be a kind of force for good in the world of Palestinian poetry, in the sense that he's doing a lot of translations as well as his own writing.
Yeah, he translated Ghassan Zaqtan's award-winning collections that won the Griffin Poetry Prize. And then starting this summer, after the Sheikh Jarrah evictions and the bombing of Gaza, he started bringing out this series of lyric dispatches on the magazine The Baffler. And you can go to The Baffler and find this series. I'm not sure if it's finished or if he's on a pause, but and there are a number of different. There's Asma Azaiza, and there's a poem by Ahlam Sharra, who is one of my personal favorites. I somehow gravitate towards these poets who also write children's books. Maybe I don't know. Maybe this is something childish about me. Who knows? But they're kind of fresh, new poems. Some translated by him, some translated by other poets as part of this series. There's one by Murid Barghouti, who also recently passed and is part of an older generation of Palestinian poets. But most of them are by younger poets. And, you know, it's exciting to, not all of the poets I knew, and it was, you know, exciting to be introduced to new work.
Yeah, and it was kind of explicitly partly done at a time when Palestine was in the news on the part of a publication that is trying to sort of highlight Palestinian voices, right? I mean,
yeah, they're called lyric dispatches, you know, which gives you this sense that they're news, although they're not really. I mean, they don't necessarily have anything. I mean, Ahlam, for example, she did write poems directly in that moment. And they were actually beautiful, stunning poems. But most of these, you know, have nothing to do with the moment. But they're sort of, yes, dispatches from Palestine, but poetry dispatches. Like, for instance, I want to read this one by Asma, which was translated by Lena Tufaha, who's also a Palestinian-American poet, as Fadi Judah is. Yesterday, I handed all my poems to my publisher. I feel like I handed him my head, and the words I speak from now on will come out of his mouth. What a disaster! Disasters don't show up one at a time. They arrive in legions like a starving horde. A poet said this, then died. For example, half my family died, and after I celebrated the end of that year, my father died. Since then, I've let my poems go. Every night, poets get drunk beneath my window and dictate wise poems to me. I loathe wisdom. I invite them in, slaughter them like fattened sheep, and dine on them, but I still can't get my voice back. I glimpse it through the window, crucified at the top of the mountain. I've become a mere reflection of a tree stripped naked in a puddle on the road. Don't step over me, shade me, from a sun that might pass overhead and vaporize my trunk. Maybe I'll speak my piece. I'll tell you disasters might die out if you stopped feeding them firewood, but you wouldn't hear me. and the mountain is made of kindling.
Nice.
I love that one. Just, you know, for her combination of sort of wit and like fierceness, and then also this, surreal lyricism that takes you on this hairpin turn somewhere you weren't expecting. Mm.
Yeah, we didn't highlight it that much, but there is wit and humor in also the poetry collections we talked about earlier. There are always glimmers of that as well, of that laughter that what is it is the excess meaning? What was Maya's line?
Is the excess knowledge no one takes seriously?
Right. Right.
Yeah, and that's not just an explanation of laughter, which she has a couple of poems talking about laughter, but also, you know, they're just funny moments where she's, you know, making fun of herself or others, people, you know, the, making fun of wise poets who she invites in. You know, this is Esme, of course, wise poets that she invites in and slaughters them like fat and sheep, which is...
right.
I don't know. I don't condone the slaughtering of fattened poets.
Wise poets.
Except in your own poetry.
Well, we will, of course, include links to all of these collections in the show notes. We should also mention that for people who are interested in poetry, there is a podcast that is also hosted on our network. So it's, there's an excellent podcast in Arabic called Maqsuda that is specifically just about poetry, and that I think you said has already done episodes on Palestinian poets.
They
right?
did one long episode on Palestinian poetry that's on YouTube with even with subtitles. And they even subtitled the poetry with poets' translations. And it's co-hosted by Zina Hashembek and Farah Shamma. And I strongly recommend that episode, which we'll link to in the show notes, and the entire, and just listening to them all the time. And to mention that Zina also has a poetry collection called O, coming out next year, 2022, and you can pre-order it now.
Yeah, it's a lovely show. I find it difficult to understand. I mean, I find it much harder to understand Arabic poetry being read aloud than, say, to like read. You know, I find poetry harder than prose, and then hearing it harder than reading it. So I can follow their discussion, but I actually have trouble when they just read the poems. And so it's very nice that I think now they're going to include transcripts. So there's, and they sort of read one poem and then they kind of unpack it, and they're both poets themselves, and it's a lovely show.
Yeah, no, I'm not that much of necessarily an oral learner. I often will call up the poem, will stop the podcast, call up the poem and read it, with my eyes at the same time that they're reading it out loud. But so yes, it's wonderful that now no one has to search around for poems anymore. They will all be published with their transcripts.
All right. And I think we're going to wrap it up there this week. On our next episode, we're going to have a special guest. Maybe we'll keep it a surprise, but we're going to be traveling back in time and looking at a traveler and a translator and the stories that he told. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks for that. And we hope you enjoyed this show. And, if you did, please remember to subscribe, share. It really helps, if you like the show, just to like, you know, retweet it or share it so that it can reach as many people as possible. That would be great.
Yes. Thanks everybody. And thank you, Ursula. I loved talking about poetry with you.
I know, me too. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.